From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe Managed IT Services, delivering a comprehensive suite of managed services, including implementing, securing, and scaling applications designed for mid-market and Fortune 1000 enterprises. DataPipe.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Remember this in last month's State of the Union address?
If American forces step back before Baghdad is secure, the Iraqi government would be overrun by extremists on all sides. We could expect an epic battle between Shia extremists backed by Iran and Sunni extremists aided by al-Qaeda and supporters of the old regime. A contagion of violence could spill out across the country. And in time, the entire region could be drawn into the conflict.
TV reporters and pundits noted that for the president, it was an unusually detailed summation. Unusual, given that so much rhetoric about the war has ignored the Sunni-Shia divide. For over a year, Jeff Stein, a national security reporter for the Congressional Quarterly, has added this final question to every interview he's conducted about Iraq with key politicians, intelligence officials, and law enforcement, to wit, do you know the difference between Sunni and Shia? For instance, which is al-Qaeda? According to Stein, the answers revealed that most officials, quote, don't have a clue. Vali Nasser is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He briefed President Bush last summer on the Shia-Sunni divide in Iraq, and he says that the newfound interest in the subject is almost certainly too little, too late.
In the sense that the region understood Iraq very quickly, very differently than Washington did. I mean, for instance, no sooner had the regime fallen that the King of Jordan used the terminology the Shia Crescent, which meant that he already, 2 years before Washington, is now saying that there is an Iranian Shia influence in this region. He already was seeing this over the horizon. We didn't realize the depth of the sectarian issue until the destruction of the Shia shrine in 2006. Up to that point, we treated the insurgency as merely resistors to democracy, foreign fighters, and Ba'athist dead-enders.
Now, you've argued that this lack of knowledge has everything to do with how we've thought of Iraq thus far. So what do you mean?
Well, we thought the issues in Iraq to be democracy versus dictatorship. We thought we were freeing Iraqis from the yoke of dictatorship and that the only issues that were before us was getting rid of the Ba'athist and creating institutions of democracy. We never understood how divided that society was and that we couldn't fix that division in the short run. In fact, that division would come to dominate everything that we were trying to do in Iraq. And not understanding that division very quickly began to doom our efforts in Iraq. And then not understanding how the division in Iraq tied to Arab-Iranian Shia-Sunni divisions in the rest of the region also complicated the way in which we responded to Lebanon, we responded to Iran. So ever since 2003, we've been playing catch-up with what sectarianism means in the region.
Now, you briefed the president last summer on this very subject, and obviously his language has been far more specific in recent weeks, notably in the State of the Union address. Why do you think he's invoking this relationship now?
Well, it is designed to underscore a shift in U.S. strategy of now focusing wholly on Iran and the Iranian problem, rather than on bringing stability to Iraq or dealing with other issues like the Arab-Israeli issue or the Lebanon issue directly. And the shift in focus on Iran requires highlighting Iran's relations with the Shias in Iraq and its relations with Hezbollah. So the use of the language, the focus on the Shia-Sunni issue, the focus on Iran is really designed to explain the new American approach.
Now, you've been critical of the way the media up till now has framed the distinction between the Sunni and the Shia and their conflicting interests in the region. What have the media generally been doing wrong?
What I'm critical of is that the media essentially has lost sort of the perspective along with the administration. When the administration shifted its focus from fighting the insurgency to focusing on the Shia militias in 2005, the media followed this in the same manner, essentially buying into the argument that the Shia militias were the biggest threat to the U.S. project in Iraq, which is not true. In reality, the most powerful military force, which is committed to the American failure in Iraq, is not the Shia militias, it's the Sunni insurgency. And the United States really stopped fighting the insurgency very effectively when it decided to shift its focus to policing sectarianism in Baghdad and to go after the Shia militias. And the media has not really questioned the wisdom or the logic of abandoning the fight against the insurgents. Essentially, the media has followed the same line of argument that the administration is following, which is just to focus on security in Iraq.
So what you're saying is you can't have a negotiation unless you know who's sitting on each side of the table. And the media has followed the government in not recognizing those sides.
Well, there is no table and there's nobody even sitting around it. And the media has essentially not focused on this issue. The administration set the goal, which is a correct goal, that there ought to be national unity in Iraq and there ought to be reconciliation. But goals are not a substitute for a diplomatic and a political process.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. Vali, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Bye-bye.
Vali Nasser is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of The Shia Revival, How Conflicts Within Islam Will Shape the Future.
If the sectarian divide till now has been lost on American policymakers, it's also true that it has only recently become a major flashpoint in much of the Middle East. And as violent as the Shia-Sunni struggle has become in Iraq, says political science professor and blogger Mark Lynch, sectarian rivalry only now has become a media preoccupation throughout the region.
During the 8-year-long war between Iraq and Iran, there was a very concerted effort, I think, on the part of a number of Arab governments to demonize the Shia as a way of building up support for Iraq in its war with Iran. So a lot of what we're hearing right now is repeating the history of the 1980s.
How are they doing so?
One example is that in mosques in Egypt, where the imams are approved by the government and there's considerable oversight, there have been a lot of really kind of nasty anti-Shia sermons being given. You're seeing a lot of it in government media, in newspapers, on TV, little video clips that are being circulated over email showing Shia political figures saying inflammatory things.
Is there a single piece, either in the print press or on some satellite channel, that for you is quintessential in demonstrating how a kind of simmering tension has begun to boil over?
I think two pieces really jump out at me. One was by an Egyptian intellectual named Fahmi Owaidi, who has long called for Sunni-Shia reconciliation. And he wrote in a piece in the newspaper Sharq al-Awsat that after Saddam's execution, he suddenly for the first time found himself feeling his Sunni identity and having real doubts about the political intentions of the Shia. The other piece was a sermon that was given by Yusuf al-Qaradawi, the Al Jazeera, very influential Sunni Islamist preacher, who in his sermon went on at some length about Shia proselytization and their attempts to convert the Sunnis to Shiism. And this is an exceptionally widely held belief. It seems to be a matter of utmost conviction across the region right now. I've seen examples of this from Algeria through Syria, through the Gulf, not to mention Egypt and Jordan, that people are absolutely convinced that large numbers of Sunnis are converting to Shiism, and yet there's almost no evidence of it.
Like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, a historical canard entirely fabricated, only this time it's a Muslim on Muslim fabrication.
I think there's a certain segment of Americans who might say that this is a good thing because it's helping to build support for confrontation against Iran. But I think you're right. It's the same kind of process of the easy demonization based on rumors and these allegations, which I think we should be very worried about.
Now, what about satellite TV? Last time you were on, we were talking about a confrontation in a debate on Al Jazeera between a firebrand Sunni and a debating opponent whom he described as a Persian shoe, in other words, an apologist for the Shiite theocracy in Iran. Tell me how that has spread throughout the Muslim world.
That program had a huge impact and generated a huge amount of debate. It's interesting, the host of that program, Dr. Faisal Al-Qassem, just published an op-ed a few days ago in which he pleaded with people not to fall for the deception of an Iranian conspiracy. He compared it to the whipping up of the fear of communism during the Cold War. So it's interesting that even though his program certainly helped contribute to some of this increasingly tense atmosphere, he's now calling on people like the Muslim Brotherhood is, like Al-Qaradawi is, and a lot of these other populist figures. Now they're calling on people to take a step back and don't fall into this, what they consider to be a trap being set by the United States and by American allies and kind of preparing way towards a war with Iran.
Well, what about the United States' position in all of this? It, after all, did just overthrow a Sunni Ba'athist regime in Iraq. There is now a Shiite-dominated government there. And yet the United States is saber-rattling towards Iran and saying, in the most public of ways, you know, keep out of Iraq or there will be very serious consequences. How is this strategy playing on the Arab street?
I've heard a number of people talking about how Iran is overplaying its hand in Iraq, that this has turned some people against Iran and against the Shia because they feel like Iran is going too far in trying to exert its hegemony over Iraq. But it doesn't lead, I think, to actually wanting to see war with Iran or confrontation with Iran. And I think that's going to be a big issue over the next few months.
Okay, Mark. Well, thank you once again.
Well, thanks for having me.
Mark Lynch is associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Williams College. You can read his ongoing analysis of Arab media at abuardvark.com.
Coming up, expectorating on the troops, menace or myth?
This is On the Media from NPR.
If you can hear me right now, then you're listening to the podcast, and we were one of the first national radio shows to offer a podcast. The thing is, it's free for you, but it costs us money. So would you consider sending our station, WNYC, a little extra to help pay for it? Just go to WNYC.org and let them know that our podcast matters to you.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Let's go back to Tuesday, 12:16 p.m., Washington, D.C., the perjury trial of the vice president's former chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby. In the witness chair, former New York Times reporter Judith Judy Miller. A Fire Dog Lake blogger offers this moment-by-moment account. Quote, Judy's back, staring forward, shifts in chair, looks toward lawyers, adjusts blouse, looks at lawyers again, looks down, folds arms, leans back, turns in swivel chair, takes glasses off, looks for tissue to wipe her hands. This is not the picture of someone who is relaxed. Miller was testifying that Libby leaked her the name of CIA operative Valerie Plame. Libby told a grand jury he didn't. Now he says he forgot. Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald says he lied. Why do we care about this trial? Three reasons. First, it reveals how the Bush administration uses strategic leaks to manage its message. Second, it exposes the fatally cozy relationship between politicians and the press. And third, it gives news junkies the chance to mainline some high-octane gossip. Assuming most of you are news junkies, you already know the background. Allegedly, Libby's leak was part of a plot to discredit Plame's husband, Joseph Wilson, a very vocal critic of the war. Washington Post columnist Dana Milbank has been watching the trial. Dana, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
I think we should begin with last Friday and the testimony of Kathy Martin, Dick Cheney's communication director. Now, that was pretty revealing of the standards and practices inside the Beltway. What did the average citizen learn about those things?
Well, to the extent the average citizen is paying any attention to the trial, which I'm sure, being very sensible, the average citizen is not doing, the average citizen would have learned that all those things that we've been whining about for the last 6 years are actually true. If the White House has bad news, they hold on to it and then dump it out late on a Friday night so nobody will pay attention to it on Saturday. If they have a real important issue, the first thing the senior people in the White House do is cut out all the official press spokespeople who actually deal with the press so they don't know about it. And we also learned that relatively junior aides in the White House essentially force upon these senior prominent cabinet officials the announcements that they have to make.
We also learned, as you wrote, that the White House coddles friendly writers and freezes out others.
I know this comes as a great surprise to you, but it came up. They were asking, well, why didn't you respond to this Nick Kristof column in the New York Times, which is sort of the first one to write about Joe Wilson, albeit not by name? And Kathy Martin's response was, well, we didn't have a really good relationship with him. And, you know, he attacked the White House all the time, but really wasn't high on our priority list. So they really sort of let their own animosity get in the way of trying to get out ahead of that story in the first place. And then we find out when the story really started getting hot, what they did was the equivalent of circling the wagons. They had, I think it was 4 or 5 prominent conservative columnists come to eat lunch with the vice president at his house at the Naval Observatory.
What, if anything, did we learn from the testimony of former White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer? Or did he prove as impenetrable as always?
Well, it's always been the case with Ari Fleischer that the longer you spend questioning him, the less information you leave the room with. This has been true in White House briefings for years. And in fact, it was true in the cross-examination where they tried to pin him down on parts of his story that didn't necessarily quite add up. There were apparent contradictions between what he said in court and what he told the grand jury. But he is so quick with an explanation. There was one time when they pointed out this inconsistency in his statement. He gave 4 explanations of why it was an inconsistency. You know, oh, well, part of it's blacked out. You can't see what it is. Well, even if I said it wrong, it's the context is perfectly correct. Then ultimately we find out that, in fact, the defense lawyer was playing fast and loose and he wasn't inconsistent in the first place. But he had 4 explanations for why, if he had been inconsistent, that would be perfectly acceptable.
He did say that he told Valerie Plame's name to then-Time reporter John Dickerson. Dickerson has written that that isn't the case.
Well, yeah, Dickerson says that, in fact, he just told Dickerson and the others who were there at the time that they should just look into it. This is all said by the dusty side of a road one day. I guess it was in Entebbe in Africa. So it's all sort of a bit of a hazy memory. What this did bring out was, of course, the absurdly incestuous nature of the whole trial. The defense lawyer flashes on the screen while he's questioning Ari Fleischer a picture of Dickerson. It actually was a glamour shot, the jacket photo from his book. And they says, you know, and I think Mr. Dickerson is here with us in the courtroom. And sure enough, there he was in the third to last row, flushing a bit and looking a bit embarrassed about the whole thing. But it happens throughout the trial. All the reporters, even the ones on the witness stand, of course, know the lawyers for the prosecution, the defense lawyers know the judge. One of the reporters knows a member of the jury. Everybody gets together and hobnobs at lunch in between the questioning. So it's all one big family reunion for the Washington establishment.
Yeah, and I wonder if that is the takeaway for the attentive citizen. I know that Libby would like us to believe that the White House set him up as a scapegoat. Judith Miller of the New York Times would like us to believe that this is the First Amendment on trial. But really, isn't it the relationship between the politicians and the press that are on trial here? And doesn't it look like both are going to be found guilty?
It doesn't show anybody in a particularly favorable light. It's a lot of sort of people using and being used and misleading and obviously being deceitful whether or not they are guilty of some criminal offense. But there's no question that people on both sides have behaved very badly.
Well, Dana, thank you very much for the update.
Happy to do it.
Dana Milbank writes the Washington Sketch column for The Washington Post. The coverage of anti-war protests is often controversial. Some complain of too much coverage, others of too little. Coverage of last weekend's protest in Washington has been the subject of heated discussion in the liberal blogosphere, not so much because of the placement of stories in newspapers and newscasts, but because of the placement of a source inside some of those stories. That source is Joshua Sparling, an Army veteran who lost part of his leg in Iraq. In the New York Times, he shows up in the 28th paragraph of an article on the march. According to that story, a belligerent protest spat on Sparling, and Sparling spat back. What the story didn't report, say critics, is that Sparling was part of an organized counter-protest, and that he seems to be a frequent victim of soldier haters, at least according to his own testimony on Fox News, where he's been a frequent guest, along with his father, both of whom have also been guests at the State of the Union, in the seats right behind Lynn Cheney. In short, say critics, this guy is not just a veteran gunslinger, but a partisan one.
The New York Times is standing by its story. They told us that its reporter witnessed the spitting incident with her own eyes. We take them at their word. After all, haven't we all heard of this kind of thing happening to vets from another unpopular war? 15 years ago, sociologist and Vietnam vet Jerry Lemke set out to trace the incidents of spitting stories in the media. He delved into press archives from the 60s and 70s, and what he found was shocking. Not a single firsthand account of a vet getting spit on, and close to no published claims by anyone so ignobly victimized.
So it really wasn't until about 1980 that these stories began to circulate. They sort of began to pop up like mushrooms in the spring and began to appear in popular culture. Films like the first Rambo film make reference to Rambo says he was spat on when he came home.
It wasn't my war. You asked me, I didn't ask you. And I did what I had to do to win, but somebody wouldn't let us win. And I come back to the world, and I see all those maggots at the airport protesting me, spitting, calling me baby killer and all kinds of vile crap.
So that's what the spitting story sounded like in 1982. Let's take a listen at what it sounds like now. Here's Josh Sparling on Sean Hannity's radio show earlier this week describing the alleged spitting incident.
That was the worst afternoon of being American that I've ever had in my life, and they actually made me feel ashamed to be a soldier almost. They kept calling me a baby killer and a murderer, and they said I was a disgrace, and I had blood covering my hands. They don't know how I sleep at night.
So here you give your leg for your country. Here you go off and you put your life at risk for your country for the right to these morons to say whatever they want at their little rally there. And the thanks you get for it is just like a lot of vets after Vietnam, you get spit at.
You know, that, and that's exactly almost how I felt. I thought back, and I'm sure it wasn't as bad as it was back then, but I just was like, wow, this is must have been what they felt like.
Apart from your particular suspicions about this incident, tell me how the story that played out last week resembled the stories that you've been following over the last 35 years.
Well, the veracity of the stories themselves is only part of what I'm interested in. Stories like this may be true or they may not be true. Of course, I can't prove that they're not true, but it's how they play into a kind of betrayal narrative for why we lost the war in Vietnam, and in this case, why it is that we would lose the war in Iraq also. The allegation here being that it's protesters at home that undermine the morale of the troops. And some Bush administration spokespeople saying that this is lending aid and comfort to the enemy. And both of these are kind of themes in the spitting stories that followed out of the Vietnam War.
So that would explain why, for example, the Fox News Channel jumped on the story, because it supported their political point of view that protesters are actually undermining not only the morale of the troops, but actually the mission itself. Has the spitting myth always been embraced for political means?
Well, it certainly goes back to other time periods and other wars, and that was one of the things that led me to begin to think about it really as a myth. Probably the strongest instance of it was in Germany after World War I. Germany lost the war, German soldiers came home, and then later told stories, wrote memoirs, wrote diaries about how when they came home, they were attacked by civilians. I mean, that's sort of the beginning of what in Germany is known as the stab in the back legend, that Germany lost the war because of home front betrayal. And of course, that led then to the scapegoating of Jews and other people that then led up to World War II. So there was that instance after World War I. And then when the French came home after their defeat in Indochina in 1954, again, there were stories like this. No spitting stories in France, but in the German instance, there were stories of soldiers being spat on, and oftentimes the spitters were women or young girls, just like in the case of many of the Vietnam War stories.
Why are we so prepared to believe that these were commonplace incidents in the Vietnam era?
Well, it's a face-saving device. It helps construct an alibi, the alibi being that we beat ourselves, that we were defeated on the home front, and that we, this most powerful nation on earth, was not defeated by this small upstart nation of Asian others. It's a dangerous myth because coming out of Vietnam, it kept alive the idea that we could win wars like Vietnam if we just stuck together as a country, if we just stayed solid behind the war effort.
I want to ask you about self-fulfilling prophecy, or maybe self-fulfilling mythology, but is it possible that as a society we have so internalized the idea of returning soldiers from unpopular wars being spat upon, that it actually becomes something that protesters might do, thinking that's, you know, the thing to do? Could that be going on right about now?
No, I think it's more the opposite. I think the internalization of the myth, I think that's a good insight. But I think it's more likely that people returning from Iraq expect to be spat on, and that what they expect is what they think happened to Vietnam veterans. So they come home looking for this to happen and looking for a chance to tell the story of how they were spat on when they came home from their war.
Okay. Jerry, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Jerry Lemke is a sociology professor at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts, and author of The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam. The Super Bowl is upon us. The National Football League is expected to pull in an astonishing $3.7 billion from the TV networks that air its games. That's a lot more than these networks will recoup by selling ad time, math that wouldn't make much sense except that over time the NFL has become much more than just a ratings powerhouse. It's also become a prerequisite for network health. Here to explain this is New York Times business writer Joe Nocera. Joe, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Okay, so why do they keep bidding more and more to get these rights?
The reason they do it is because as cable becomes more and more important and as television becomes narrower and narrower, there are not that many venues that bring together large groups of people, particularly men, in one place, the way television used to do in the old days when there were only three networks.
This phenomenon seems to trace back to 1993, when what was then the dinky little Fox network doubled CBS's bid for the rights to broadcast the NFC games. What happened to Fox after that, and what happened to CBS?
Well, first of all, it put Fox on the map. I mean, it really made Fox a real network. Nobody denies that. And there were actually affiliate stations that defected from CBS to Fox just because of football. CBS, meanwhile, not only lost affiliate stations, but they saw their ratings tank. And, you know, you think to yourself, well, maybe it's coincidence. But then CBS got football back a few years later, and its ratings started to go up again.
That's the environment. But add to it one other factor, the NFL Network, a relatively obscure cable network that's mostly, I guess, on digital cable, not on basic cable, which up until this year, anyway, hadn't aired any actual NFL games. This year, the NFL did take games, I think 8 of them, and instead of selling them to a broadcast network, put them on the NFL Network, which, you know, very few people have access to. What's going on there?
Well, the NFL wants to use these games as leverage, as power, to force the cable stations, Comcast and Time Warner Cable, and those companies, to put the NFL Network on their basic cable for a lot of money. Right now, the NFL Network charges, I think, 25 cents per subscriber. And if they could force the cable companies to take these games on cable television, they want to charge 70 cents per subscriber per month. I mean, it's a game of chicken between the cable companies, which are very resistant to this, and the NFL, which is basically insisting on it.
In your piece in The Times, you quoted an analyst as saying that the NFL is trying to create a perception of scarcity. Another way of putting it is extortion.
Extortion by football? Come now, Bob. They know that football is really popular. They know that people really want it. And they know that cable companies are very unpopular in the public mind. So their thought was, if we offer this wonderful package of football games, the football-loving population would rise up and demand it, and the cable companies would cower and crater. The truth of the matter is, as a general rule, the content providers usually win these battles. I mean, think about Disney versus Time Warner. I mean, think about the various battles revolving around that. This year, the cable companies did not crater, but ultimately, I think they will just because they'll have to.
Can you foresee a circumstance in which the NFL, as popular as it is and as good as the product is that it delivers, just simply overplays its hand?
In a word, no. I mean, the NFL has a history of playing this stuff beautifully. I just do not think they will do something that will devalue their currency.
All right, Joe. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Joe Nocera is a business columnist for the New York Times and a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine.
Coming up, the evolving image of the Arab seen through Hollywood's lens.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. It started off like any other terrorist scare. We've seen plenty of them in the last 5 years, what with our office TVs tuned into cable news morning till night. So many, in fact, that when the caption screamed security threat on Wednesday, it was 15 minutes before we took the TVs off mute.
Developing news happening right here today in the CNN newsroom. It's actually happening in Boston. Live pictures now. Let's take you 5 suspicious packages planted near bridges and others.
It's not insignificant where these devices are found. We're talking 3 bridges
right.
And a hospital.
Correct.
The targets, the likely targets of a terrorist
attack. Our local Fox station in Boston is now reporting 6 devices. A 6th
device and had other components that are consistent with improvised explosive devices. However, they underscored that no explosives were found in that package. Nor
it looks like the whole thing may have been a hoax. All of the devices that were found, for all practical purposes, turned out not to be explosives.
The saturation coverage continued throughout the afternoon, and then the story turned strange.
The device itself, it's a blackboard with sort of white pegs on it. It resembles a cartoon character.
Cartoon Network program called Aqua Teen Hunger Force, which just released a feature-length movie last week.
That's Fox News' Shepard Smith. But we watched the news conference on CNN, which was lucky because right after officials grumpily reminded whoever was responsible that they'd be facing serious jail time, we heard something of a scoop on CNN.
The packages in question are part of an outdoor marketing campaign in 10 cities in support of Adult Swim's animated television show Aqua Teen Hunger Force. And then from Turner Broadcasting, we regret that they were mistakenly thought to pose any danger.
We bet they regret it. After all, Turner Broadcasting is not only the parent company of the Cartoon Network, Court TV, TBS, and Money Magazine, but also of CNN, the venerable news outlet that had been gravely reporting on the threat for the previous 2 hours. Oops. But then another big break in the story and an even bigger break for CNN.
Well, Wolf, we can tell you that apparently this was done by a third-party marketing campaign. Interference marketing is what we are being told.
Aha! A third party. For Turner Broadcasting, this diversion was manna from heaven. Interference marketing consisted of two 20-somethings mugging for the cameras in handcuffs the following morning. These guys were weird. And look at that one guy's dreadlocks. Around midday, they posted bail and held a news conference. One reporter asked how they felt.
I feel like my hair is pretty perfect. But altogether, I want to redirect this onto the topic of haircuts in the 70s because I want to educate myself about it a little bit more.
Yeah. What was it like to spend last night in jail?
That's not a hair question. I'm sorry.
Wait a minute. After all, this was serious business. The city of Boston was out almost $1 million in emergency response funds. The networks agreed. It was, quote, an exercise in bad publicity, a marketing fiasco, as the screen was filled with B-roll images of Aqua Teen Hunger Force.
You know, Aqua Teen Hunger Force, the cartoon with the new movie? They say all publicity is good publicity, but not for Turner Broadcasting, which may also be facing prosecution. Maybe this display of the media beast consuming its own tail will go down as an object lesson in the unintended consequences of media consolidation. But even if it doesn't, if this episode results in more skepticism directed at cable's incessant scare stories, it won't have been a total waste of time, because cable news hysterics, now that's a package worthy of everyone's suspicion.
This week in the New York Times, a story on a new show called On the Road in America, now airing on an Arab satellite TV network called the Middle East Broadcasting Center, or MBC. Produced by Washington-based Leilina Productions, On the Road in America is a reality show that follows Arabs on an American cross-country adventure. But it's also more than that. It's a campaign to win the hearts and minds of viewers in the Middle East, and maybe someday here in the U.S., too. Because Leilina Productions is not just your average TV production company. Its board includes George H.W. Bush, James Baker, Lee Hamilton, Brent Scowcroft, and Henry Kissinger, a crew presumably more versed in foreign diplomacy than reality TV. But sometimes they are one and the same. Richard Fairbanks, former Mideast peace negotiator during the Reagan administration, is the founder of Leilina, and he joins us now. Ambassador, welcome back to On the Media.
Thank you very much.
Now, obviously, this isn't just about being popular. You're a former Mideast peace negotiator during the Reagan administration. I assume you see reality TV and foreign diplomacy converging in this project.
Well, certainly we wouldn't have started the project if we didn't think we could have a positive impact on breaking down barriers and stimulating critical thinking in the Arab world about us. And conversely, since we're going to try to sell it back in the United States, this reality show is only the first of many we've planned. For example, one member of our board of counselors, Don Hewitt, who was the inventor of 60 Minutes, is leaving for Dubai to look into setting up an equivalent of 60 Minutes called The Hour in Arabic, that we would co-produce again with NBC to be shown on their all-news network called Al Arabiya. And we also have a scripted drama comedy series in the works called How's Your Arabic? We have a children's program called Ben and Izzy. So we have a variety of types of programs, all intended not to lecture, not to say, you stupid people out there, you ought to listen to us, but hopefully to have an impact for the better.
We have seen, since 9/11, attempt after attempt by the government to create a more positive image of the United States in the Arab world, and they've all failed. What do you think went wrong there, and what do you think you're doing right?
Well, I can't say we're going to solve all the problems, but one problem the government has that we don't have is that they're the government, and people tend to say, oh my goodness, that's government propaganda. I don't think that that's going to be able to reach as many people, and hopefully not as persuasively, as we can with the private sector initiative.
You say much of the Arab world turns off American government media because it has that official imprimatur. But let's face it, they're suspicious of the message also because, in many instances, the message feels phony.
Exactly right. But ours is not a message. And what we did was bring these three young Arab boys here, follow them around the country, let them interact with Americans from a variety of parts of the country and a variety of walks of life, and just recorded what they said, what they thought, what they heard, and what their reactions were, and let that speak for themselves. And so we are not proselytizing. We're just saying, here's some things you haven't seen before. What do you think of that? And I think that kind of critical thinking can be very useful.
But, of course, reality TV, the narrative, is created through the editing. And I wonder whether sometimes the editors take a rather nervous knife to some of what these experiences are.
Well, actually, I think it's pretty representative of what they saw and talked about, etc. There was a quote in the newspaper the other day saying, oh, my goodness, one of the young boys said something critical of the administration. Well, tough luck. That was what he said, and it's in there. And we did some Bowdlerized version of cutting out anything that was negative about the United States. We would have the kind of show that people wouldn't want to watch. I think we need to show the reality of what they saw, and there's a tremendous difference, interestingly enough, from what they were saying about the United States when they arrived to what they were saying after they'd been here for a couple of months in this filming and went back home. And I think that speaks for itself, and I think it will speak directly to the demographic that we're trying to reach out in the Arab world.
What was that difference?
Well, according to them, it was they arrived here saying, we don't like this country, we don't like your policies, people say it's just President Bush's fault, but you guys voted for him, and so this is the kind of country that we are not going to like, and we are predisposed to dislike Americans as well as the country. And by the end of it, they said, gosh, Americans were so nice to us out here, we can't decide whether it's because we're on this program or because Americans are really nice. And so there was a tremendous change of view in the participants in the show as they went through it. One young Palestinian woman who was part of the show for about half of it said, I can't stand Israelis and I hate all Jews. And then she found out that the cameraman who was following around was an Israeli. And by the end of the show, she and the cameraman were having long conversations. And, you know, she didn't say, I've now fallen in love with you and I want to move to Israel. But she said, I can't believe we can have a rational conversation. This is very different from what I thought it would be. So it's, again, it's not dictating to people, lecturing to people. It's letting the reality of a point of view they don't normally get present itself to them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was wonderful to talk to you again.
Richard Fairbanks is the founder of Leilina Productions. While he strives to acquaint the Arab world with the real America, Arab Americans struggle to acquaint their fellow Americans with themselves. And like it or not, the path to understanding runs straight through Tinseltown. That's the subject of a special about Hollywood's depiction of Arabs that airs next week on the new TV channel Al Jazeera English. It's called Hollywood Casting the Enemy, and you'll probably have to stream it online. The channel has virtually no cable distribution here. But if you do, you'll see how tough it is to buck Hollywood's most durable, demeaning stereotype. Take the 1994 Schwarzenegger action flick, True Lies.
One turn of that key, 2 million of your people will die instantly.
What key?
That key! Who's taking the key?
They simply act stupid. They are stupid. But at the same time, they threaten to kill us. So their stupidity has to be taken seriously.
Jack Shaheen is the author of Real Bad Arabs. That's real with two E's. He says True Lies marks another new low in the pernicious portrayal of Arabs across a century of American cinema. Back in the era of the silent film, Arabs weren't quite so dumb, but they were certainly dangerous.
Initially, it was always the Arab Bedouin out to go into the legionnaire's fort, slaughter each and every member of the legion, and then moved to seduce the blonde, blue-eyed virgin, who, of course, was standing there with a pistol in her hand, ready to commit suicide in the event that a Bedouin bandit would in fact have the opportunity to seduce her, which fortunately he never did.
The image of the Bedouin and the dastardly sheik who commands him have endured in America's imagination forever. But now they're even more threatening, and not just on the big screen.
Now we are being projected in shows such as 24, Navy NCIS, The Unit, and others, dozens of others actually, as clones of Al-Qaeda and clones of Saddam, a threat to our country. Why project American citizens as a threat to their country?
Why, indeed? In recent times, a few Arab citizens of some European nations have given cause for alarm. There, but not here. So why, even long before 9/11, this Hollywood obsession? Habit, says Shaheen, and history.
Do you think this extremist image finds its roots in the Munich Olympics?
Not only what happened in Munich, I think the Iranian Revolution had a part to play, even though Iranians are not Arabs. Most of us think they are. The Arab-Israeli conflict, the oil embargo. I think news headlines play a dominant role in terms of how we project and perceive a people. I also believe that, you know, we were taught to hate all things Arab for so many years, which helped make our going to Iraq that much easier.
I know the people where I'm from in Texas are forming their opinions from watching shows like 24.
Josh Rushing, a former U.S. Marine captain, hosts that special on Al Jazeera English that tracks Hollywood's shabby treatment of Arab characters.
My question throughout this show was, well, what do you do to change it? It's got to change from the inside, and that means Arab screenwriters and Arab directors and producers making movies that have a more thoughtful portrayal of Arabs.
In his conversations with actors ranging from Omar Sharif to Tony Shalhoub, Rushing learns what every actor knows. You take the parts you get until you have enough clout to create your own. That's how Tony Shalhoub created Monk, the hit series about an obsessive-compulsive detective whose ethnicity is unknown and irrelevant. But somehow, actor Seyed Bedreya, who has no clout, managed to produce and star in a signature short called Tea for Terrorist.
It's an actor that's tired of always being cast as the terrorist, so he gets cast as that again. He shows up on set, and he actually hijacks the set, and he makes the director play the terrorist, and he gets to play the good guy for once.
Do you guys really think I look like a terrorist?
Kinda.
I can do more than that. I can be the second Kelly Goober.
You mean Gary Cooper?
Whatever.
That was my story.
Seyed Bedreya.
Because I used to sit on the set and look at the movie star and the hero and everything. And I said, why not for one day I can be a hero? Why not for one day I can have the girl?
Bedreya was a kid growing up in Egypt in the time of the Six-Day War when he was seduced by American movies. When he said he was going Hollywood, his friends said he was crazy. But he did. He was a handsome Arab actor. In America, there were no parts for handsome Arab actors, so he grew a beard, put on some weight.
Then when I went to the audition, I was angry, and they said, yeah, this is what we're looking for. This is the real thing.
Can you tell me about some of the bad guy roles that you played in the 80s and 90s?
Well, I hijacked an aeroplane in executive decision. I blew up places in True Lies. I kidnapped people. I done everything bad.
So he worked, though his parts found little favor in the Arab-American community. Then, not long ago, his friend Peter Farrelly, yes, of the infamous Farrelly brothers, told him it was time to produce something from his heart. So Bedreya has just wrapped up American East, a film about an Arab-American family man who opens up a restaurant with his best friend, who's Jewish. The friend is played by Tony Shalhoub. The goal? The depiction of ordinary men.
For my kids, I don't want my kids to change his name from Muhammad to Michael because the Arab image is bad. No, I want him to have his name, Muhammad, and Muhammad doesn't mean terrorist. And that's what we bring in American East to talk about an Arab-American family who struggled after 9/11.
9/11 must figure into any discussion of Arab images in America. It should have made a bad situation worse, but in fact, it hasn't. Josh Rushing.
It is counterintuitive, but there is this kind of a germ of people wanting to understand in Hollywood that probably wasn't happening before 9/11.
Film historian Jack Shaheen says maybe 90% of Arab images post 9/11 are still shallow and demeaning, but...
The encouraging news is there have been several post 9/11 films, Babel, Kingdom of Heaven, Syriana, where there have been portraits presenting Arabs as we see other people, no better, no worse.
Now it's time to refine the portraits of Arab Americans, says Sayed Badreya.
Hollywood had to learn we are American. It happened to be Arab. We are American because we choose to come to this country. What is America? I grew up in a ghetto and I end up in Hollywood doing movie with movie star George Clooney and all this stuff. That's America. It gives you the dream, but you have to work for it.
Badreya's new film, American East, is slated for release later this year. Hollywood Casting the Enemy airs several times on Al Jazeera English next week. Cannonball Run 2, hopefully, will never be seen again.
Here, my desert blossom, give the change. Have you ever considered joining a harem?
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Alicia Rebensdorf and Michael McLaughlin. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. And thanks.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.